view took place with a Mr. H.P. Gutsling of 1313 Johnston Street on the 22nd of June 1976. The interviewer was myself, Bill Augustine, a 504 oral history class student. The subject of the tape is mainly Mr. Gutsling's 50 years of railroad experience in South Texas. There are other short incidents relating to his experience, not necessarily associated with the railroad, but most of the tape has to do with his railroad experiences. His parents moved from Minnesota in approximately 1922 to South Texas. So the tape consists of stories and experiences dating back to 1922.
Distances on.
Yeah. Mr. Gutsling, could you give us an idea, let us know where you're from, when you first came to South Texas?
Well, all of the Gutslings, the kin folks on my mother's side, Olenkamps, were from southern Minnesota, all the way across from Worthington to Fairmont, across the southern tip of Minnesota, and were farmers. And my father wanted new faces to see and new things to conquer, so he came to South Texas and in the grain industry, namely corn, and built elevators, things of that nature, and we settled in McAllen in the year 1912. We lived in McAllen from 1912 to 1922, or the latter part of 22 and the early part of 23, when we moved to Kingsville. And I have been a resident of Kingsville ever since.
Very good. We were talking just a couple minutes ago, and you were talking about rattlesnakes. Let's hear that again.
Well, sir, I've had some nice experience with rattlesnakes. We moved down here in 1912. We didn't have a house, and we lived in a tent. And my mother was washing clothes one day, and she had given me a piece of bread and butter to eat as a lunch, sort of, and she'd watch me every once in a while. And I was about 2 years old, I guess, and she would glance out and see why I was getting along. One time she glanced out there, and I was offering my piece of bread and butter to a huge rattlesnake who was crawling down the path directly toward me. In fact, he measured over 5 feet in length and had over 11 rattles when we finally killed him. And my mother grabbed me and run in the tent and got the shotgun and come back and killed him. And I was trying to feed him, and she shot him, and then she explained to me how bad they were and everything. And about 3 months later, in this same location, we still hadn't had a house built, and she was hanging out of clothes. She had the old-fashioned clothespin, not the snap type, but the push-down type. And whenever she'd break off a part of that clothespin, she'd give me the clothespin to play with. She looked over there, and I sat nowhere with his clothespin, and I had a little rattlesnake about a foot long, and I was trying to kill this little rattlesnake with this clothespin because she had told me how mean they were and how bad they were, and me not realizing the poisoning about them, I was trying to chop his head off with his clothespin.
Did you do it? Your mother took care of that one, huh?
Yeah. I have had some other experiences that possibly no one else, well, I won't say no one else, but very few other people have had. I've fallen into cactus 3 times in my life. And on one occasion, I turned around just as I fell into the cactus, and I screamed. I was about 7, 8 years old, and I screamed. And I remember, even to this day, that they extracted some of those cactus pines out of my tongue, even, with tweezers, much less my other parts of my body. Three times.
Tell me something. Most of your life you were associated with the railroad. When did you start with the railroad?
Well, I started railroading at a very early age because we had settled in Kingsville to live here, and of course, in Kingsville, it was either ranching or railroading or farming. That was about all there was to be done. And we didn't own any property, therefore, the only thing I could turn to was railroading, which at that time my father was also in the railroad. He was railroading. And of course, like any other young American boy at that time, the train whistles and things in the early part of the morning, well, it just had a natural knack to kind of draw young men to railroading. I guess that possibly 70% of the youth of America wanted at one time or other to be an engineer, because whistling of the trains, the rumbling of them, and the romantic side of it. And I started railroading at a very early age. In fact, I was about 14. I started railroading on and off. I'd go to school for 6 months, and then I'd take a leave absence and go to railroading, or vice versa. I done that for about 5 or 6 years until I managed to get on regular on the railroad. I served machinist trade, but not liking the confinement of working in an office, I mean working in a shop, I transferred as soon as possible to what I thought was a more romantic side of the railroading, which was the train service. As a fireman, as an engine watchman first, and worked up to a fireman, and then as a fireman, worked up to an engineer. I remember the old time railroading and what it was today. We worked for, at one time my salary on the railroad was $55 a month for 6 days away from home work. And I fed myself. Of course, with the increase in everything else, progress being what it was and is, why now, of course, those things are not as inadequate. They are good jobs and they draw good salaries.
We were talking last week about tuning a whistle. How did you do that?
Back in the olden days, the engineers used to take real big pride in their work. They would tune a whistle. The whistle, of course, was operated by steam, and by screwing the cap down, you could change the tone of it. And some of the engineers would tune their own whistle so that if you heard them 6-8 miles away, why, you could almost tell what engineer it was by the sound of the whistle. And that was one of the engineers many years ago used to have their name painted on the cab. Excuse me. Painted on the cab, their lodge emblem, and their name. And many years ago, they used to have their own individual engine. And whenever that engine went in the shop for repair, the engineer went with it. He didn't stay out there and work just any old engine. He worked his engine, and that was all.
We were also talking about strike in 1922. Could you say a few words about that, or many words, whatever you want to say?
Well, the strike in 1922, of course, was one of the outstanding strikes of the railroad industry. It was nationwide. It was a shopman's strike, which meant that the engineers and firemen, conductors and trainmen, didn't go on strike. They kept working. The shopmen were the only men that went on strike, the mechanics. And this strike, of course, was lost. It was the last big strike, big general strike, and it was lost. And it had a lot of peculiar incidents to happen, of course. A lot of the work was done at outside points, which had to be, of course, to keep the railroad operating.
You were mentioning also the fact that people switched locations. The union men from one location switched to another job?
Yes, this isn't very, very much to brag about, really, from the standpoint of a union member, but one of what I feel, one of the contributing factors to losing the strike was that the men would go out on strike at one point and maybe go 1,000 miles away and go to work at another point, and thereby defeating their own purpose. They were supplying journeyman workers only at different locations. And in my opinion, this is one of the reasons why that the 1922 strike was lost.
Why was the 1922 strike so important? I mean, was that the last big strike, or do you think it meant something as far as railroading was concerned?
It was the last nationwide strike, yes, and I guess possibly one of the most costly in the railroad industry, because of the nature of it being nationwide.
Remember any funny stories or any funny incidents while you were an engineer or fireman or during your railroading career? Things that stand high in your mind today yet.
At one time on our railroad, we had a bandit uprising many years ago, and some of the bandits from across the border raided the train and wrecked it, in which an old engineer by the name of Bentley was injured because they turned the engine over at Brownsville, Texas, and necessitated amputating the old gentleman's leg, and he got an iron leg out of it from his knee down, and he was the only engineer that I ever knew of that had that big a handicap and kept right on working. He kept on working until he retired at a ripe old age. We used to affectionately call him Iron Leg Bentley.
Did they ever catch the bandits?
No, they never did. The bandits made restitution after years of negotiation for these raids, but they've raided as far north as Norias, which is about 50 or 60 miles south of Kingsville.
Okay. You mentioned the bandits made restitution. You mean they were actually caught?
Well, the governments. The governments made restitution.
Restitution. Oh, I see. Did you ever have any, let's say, real exciting things happen to you? Derailment? A holdup? Anything that... fires? Floods? Or anything like that?
In my own personal category, the most drastic thing that has happened was a fire in a bridge, in which eventually led to my retirement south of Bloomington, Texas. I had 132 cars in the train, three engines. One of them stopped completely, and the other two weren't operating too pert, and we had quite a bit of grain, which is very heavy, in our train, and as we came down the natural slope there at Bloomington coming south, I noticed a fire at the foot of the bridge. The fireman was running the engine under my instructions, and I hollered and told him not to set any of the brakes because we had to try to make it up what we called a McFadden Hill, because the bridge was burning. There wasn't any way to put it out. We radioed back to Bloomington, told them the bridge was burning. We might have to have some help. When we finally got up the McFadden Hill, as far as the engine would go, as far as the engine would pull a train, why, we still liked about two or three car lengths clearing the bridge. So we wired back for some instructions, and they told us to back up, take another run at it. which we did, and this time we got about 47 cars across it, and the bridge caved in. And this was the worst thing that happened, the biggest tragedy that happened in my railroad career from the year up until I retired in 1975.
And about what year did this happen? We were just talking about.
About this bridge burning?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was in 75. That was right at the last of my railroading career.
Uh-huh. You say you got 47 cars over, and there were how many in the train?
There was 132, I think.
What happened to the other cars?
They were still on the track. They were backfilled.
Oh, I see. Last week we were talking about the road beds. You were saying they're not like they were years ago.
Well, of course, now, I guess that I'd probably stir up quite a bit of argument about this, because the maintenance way department on the railroad would probably take me to task over this, but I don't think that the mechanical machines that keep up the road bed today do as good a job as the old hand tools or the old section man. Used to on the railroad, you'd see somewhere between 10 to 12, 14 section men every 12 to 15 miles on the railroad. Today, you don't see but about 4 section men about every 25 miles. And they're doing everything with machines, which, like I say, I believe that a hand-tamped tie with the old section labor is a lot better tamped tie, a lot better road bed, in my opinion. Of course, I'm not a track man. But by my years out there, it just seems to me like it's more costly. Costs the railroad company a lot more. However, I think it's a better road bed. Now, they may argue with me about that.
What caused the steam engine to be replaced by the diesel?
Well, of course, the terrific cost of the operation of the old steam engine. Back in the steam engine days, you had a water tank about every 20 to 20, well, anywhere from usually not further away than 35, 40 miles from each other. You had huge water tanks in which you had to take water in your locomotives in order to make your run. Where today you don't take water maybe once a week on a locomotive, which would be one thing. And then, of course, same thing is true where it used to take us 30 to 40,000 gallons of water to make a run. Why now it probably wouldn't take you over a gallon and a half, 2 gallons, because radiator is all you worry about now for water. Where it used to, why, it was half of your power or more. And the same is true with the terrific amount of oil that we used to have to take when we converted the water into steam, which today, of course, you burn the diesel fuel and you don't need near as much of it per unit.
When did the engine switch from coal to oil?
Well, of course, now in southern Texas, in the very southern part of Texas, on the railroad which I'm familiar with, we never had coal. Our ours was always oil burners. Now, in other parts of South Texas, I understand some of the railroads did have coal, but ours was always oil burners. And they switched over in the, I believe it was somewhere in the 40s, the switch began to take place.
You mentioned 30 to 40,000 gallons of water. That was good for how many miles?
We'd make 100 to 120 miles.
So actually, you couldn't have had railroads in South Texas until there were some big wells, right?
That's right. Well, the railroad company, of course, had their own wells. They had their own water tanks. And they had their own crew, which was the water department. And these fellas operated up and down the track on a little motor car, and they'd go and be sure there was water in all the tanks. That was part of their duties. And like I say, now, of course, when you went to diesel, why, this was one of the parts of the railroad that was eliminated, which was, in my opinion, a huge saving to the railroad company. Then, of course, along with the saving of the diesel engine, you could go so much further with it and everything that the repair of it, concentrated in huge shops, and you take the city of Kingsville itself. At one time, we had over 800 men working in the railroad shop here the year around. Today we don't have anybody working in the shop here. At one time the general offices of the Gulf Coast Lines was situated in Kingsville and had a two-story office building which has been tore down and replaced by the Humble building. But at one time they employed somewhere between 800 and 1,000 employees in the office, the general office there. So the diesel engine and the transfer from steam to diesel power has really affected Kingsville.
I see. When did this big change take place, roughly?
Well, it was a kind of a gradual process. By that I mean that they brought a few diesels down. And at one time, we didn't know whether we were going to work a steam engine or a diesel engine. Because, in my opinion, I believe that the transfer from one to the other took over a period of 4 to 6 years. Actually, before the complete change was consummated.
I'm going to take you back a little bit. Remember the Depression?
Yes, sir.
Okay, a lot of people, particularly like today's young people, don't realize what it was like during that time. You were working for the railroad during the Depression?
I was cut off during the
You were cut off during the Depression. Then
worked,
what did
worked
you do?
Occasionally. I would work. Well, when I got cut off, usually I would go and find a job roughnecking in the oil field, which took me sometimes as far as Refugio. I roughnecked in Refugio from Refugio to Mission, Texas, wherever I could find a roughnecking job.
How did you know when to get back on the railroad then? I mean, in other words, you were out of contact, so how would you know that a job had come up?
Well, of course, you'd have your friends around, some of them that were working, and you would depend on them more or less to let you know if the working by seniority was a big help, because you'd be cut off with a certain group of people. And whenever that bunch would start going back to work, why, you'd know that your number was either had been called back or that you were going to be called back in the near future.
Oh, I see. When did you start back on the railroad regular then, or close to regular?
Well, in the 40s, about 1940.
Well, where was that run?
From Houston to Kingsville.
How come they put such a fast train on between Houston and Kingsville? What was so important?
Well, it really wasn't necessary, except that they were advertising the link with the nation of Mexico, and out of Houston, and that would be about the only reason I could tell.
This was a steam?
Steam engine, yes, sir.
When was this?
Oh, goodness. I'd be scared to say.
No, before World War II?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, this was before World War II.
Most of your experience has been in the freight line. Then.
Oh, yes. Yes. Because the passenger trains were considered the preferred jobs. And, of course, our jobs went by seniority. And about the only way that I would catch a passenger train would be for the regular man to be sick, and I'd fill in his place.
I understand that, as you said, seniority, of course, that meant passenger trains were the better job. But what did you do, get your load there faster?
Well, you'd get your work done a lot quicker. I mean, the job between Kingsville and Brownsville would take approximately 4.5 hours, and you'd make your day's work. Your day's work would be done in about 4.5 hours. So naturally, that job was considered the preferred job.
And then you'd come back the next day, right?
And then the next day, you'd come back with about 4.5 hours again, which was a real good job.
You then have to leave the next day again.
Yeah.
So you were gone most of the time.
Well, this, of course, is true in most any railroad man's life that is on the road. By that, I mean like your bridge man or your maintenance way man and your train and engine service people. We are all gone from home at least half of our life, because that's where the work is and that's where you got to be. I remember years ago when I was first starting railroading, and railroading, most of my railroading then was maintenance way work on the track out there, operating drag lines and bulldozers, weed burners, and those type of machine, which was used in the upkeep of the track. I remember that the first 7 or 8 years that I was married, I spent about 6 of them away from home and about a year at home, because I was gone 6 days a week, and I'd come in Sunday morning and leave Sunday night for work.
When were you married?
Married in 1932.
That's close enough.
She'll whip me.
No. So your wife really is engineer also. She had to go through all this with you?
Yeah, she's been with me all the way. But at 32, he's married in Prussia. During the war. I remember back during the war, we were speaking of Holly. Back during the war, the good Lord was good to us. He let us have at least 100 cars of vegetables a night out of the valley during vegetable season for about 6 months. And We'd have 100 cars of vegetables, solid vegetables, come out of that valley, at least that many, every night. And we'd have the same amount going down there. And now, of course, you very seldom, hardly ever see any vegetables being hauled on the railroad. The railroad don't haul vegetables anymore.
Why is that?
They don't haul vegetables because of the cost. It costs the railroad company in claims almost more than what they make in revenue. And the same way with cattle. They don't even have any cattle cars anymore because it just costs too much in claims to haul the cattle by rail.
I don't quite understand that. What do you mean, cost and claims?
Well, sir, they'll have some cattle bunged up or even killed, and then they'll turn in claims for money for the cattle, of course, the rancher will, and they have to stop and let these cattle out once a day and graze them and feed them. And the delay and all, it's just not financially successful for the railroad company to handle this type of business.
So the cattle get to market now by truck? Is that how they get there?
Yeah.
When did the railroad quit hauling cattle and vegetables? After World War II? Or?
After World War II. Since you mentioned hauling cattle, at one time at Caesar Creek, right north of Kingsville here, they used to have a huge billboard that set out by the side of the track. It was approximately, I'd say, 40, 50 feet high and a couple of hundred feet long. And it used to have a great big sign on there that says, "This is the largest stock loading point on the entire Missouri Pacific Railroad." And it wasn't unusual years ago for us to load anywhere from 50 to 150 cars of cattle a day and transport them out of there from the King Ranch. Now they can't even haul one car of cattle because they don't have a cattle car.
That's true. I haven't noticed any cattle cars in years. Very true.
Whatever livestock they handle today, they handle in baggage cars. They take baggage cars and handle them in baggage cars, like racehorses, things of that type.
So the railroads mostly now just haul what? Chemicals. And boxed, I would imagine, just boxed merchandise, no fresh.
No. Chemicals and huge iron equipment, like those great big towers and stuff for the oil fields. Now they have some of those that take 6 and 8 flat cars to put them.
Okay. You said earlier you spent much of your time in Brownsville, about half the time. Is that where?
Quite a bit of time in Brownsville because I always liked to work south of Kingsville. Kingsville South, for some reason, I always liked to work down there. And if I had a chance, that's where I'd hold a job.
Did you notice many changes in Brownsville, besides Kingsville, during your time on the railroad? Did you notice Brownsville get bigger?
Well, yes. I never noticed it, of course, as much as I did Kingsville, but I noticed that it did increase in population and in size. The city limits would come out further. Every 4, 5, 6 years, it'd get further and further out. Kingsville, when I moved here, I think it was about if my memory serves me right, was about 8,000 population.
And most of the people here worked for the railroad then?
Oh, yes. It was strictly a railroad town at that time, railroad and ranching town at that time, which was even before the A&I College. I was a Boy Scout and helped to direct traffic back in 1924 when Ma Ferguson laid the cornerstone.
Ma Ferguson, huh?
Yeah, governor.
Right.
Governor Ma Ferguson.
Right. Did Texas Rangers ever have to ride your train at all because of bandits or any problems?
Yes, of course. That was before my railroading time. I remember that back during the bandit uprisings, why they had the Rangers a lot of times to come in and help out banditos during a raid on the trains. Like I say, of course, that was back before 1920.
The other day when I was talking to Mr. Reese, we got on the question of blacks working for the railroad. And he said the predominant job that the blacks had on the railroad was a brakeman. And the reason this was so was that years ago that neither Anglos nor Mexican-Americans would be brakemen because brakemen got shot at too much. So that's one of the reasons that the blacks took the job. Have you heard this before?
This is very definitely true. The condition like that, and then of course the bad condition of walking up and down the track with the rattlesnakes, one thing and another, why the white man, he shunned away from the job of being a brakeman. They just didn't want them. And we had a general manager by the name of Mr. Shope, W.G. Shope, and I think that some of the negotiations between the brakemen at that time and Mr. Shope was the fact that Mr. Shope had promised them that they could work as long as they wanted to as brakemen on this railroad. And even the big powerful unions, when they tried to change that about, were told pretty straightforward, no sir, these men stuck with me, by God, when you wouldn't work them and the jobs, and now I'm going to stick with them. Those were more or less Mr. Schultz's words.
You mentioned unions, and the unions were trying to do what?
Was trying to take the brakeman jobs.
Oh, I see. So Mr. Schultz was actually protecting the blacks?
He definitely did, yes sir.
What is the job of a brakeman, anyhow?
Well, of course, his job is to cut off the correct amount of cars and put them in the track specified in a town. When you get into a town, you've got what you call a switch list. And on this switch list shows you which cars the railroad company wants set out there and where they want them set out. And this is the job of the brakeman. The conductor is to oversee the work and see that it's done. And the brakeman has to find where these cars are in the train. Then he has to cut them off and switch them out and put them in proper order in the town while the conductor is up at the depot getting his orders and talking to the boss. By that I mean possibly the train master at another point on the railroad, and explaining to him that this work is being done. And this is more or less the job of the brakeman, and then of course they're to oversee the look the train over as they operate along. And whenever they stop, they're supposed to get on the ground and look at as many cars as they can to see that the cars are still, that everything's operating as it's supposed to.
I didn't know until you explained to me the other day that I always thought the engineer ran the train, but it's a conductor. Is that right? He's the top dog?
Well, sir, now, of course, this has been an argument among the engineers and the conductors ever since there's been a railroad. Who is the head authority? And the best that I can figure out from the 51 years experience I've had out there and everything is that as far as the engine is concerned, the engineer is the supreme authority. As far as the cars are concerned, back there, the conductor is the supreme authority. The rules of the railroad most generally read that the authority is vested in the engineer and conductor, or the conductor and the engineer.
If the train runs late, who gets the blame?
If the train runs late, of course, then depending on the seriousness of the offense, why? If it's mechanical trouble, then of course it would be the engineer and the machine. If it's trouble with the crew or trouble with the cars, then of course it would be the conductor and the brakeman.
Have you ever had a conductor tell you what to do?
Yes, on numerous occasions.
Who won?
Well, that of course now is going to go back to the old argument that if it was the engine, I'd win. If it was the cars out there, he'd win, or the operation. But I always felt that the engine was the engineer's, that was his business, because he had to see to it. It was up to him to have it running and being able to move the train.
Safety of the train overall is whose job, the conductor or the engineers?
Both, equal authority.
I see. Did you ever know Mr. Kerrigan?
Yes, I did. Know him well. Fine man.
He was a conductor for, I guess, well, not for all that time, but I guess he's one of the old line conductors.
Yes, he is. Many, many years.
Any funny stories to tell about him?
Well, sir, I always heard, I don't know how true it is, and I wouldn't want to be quoted to or pinned down to making an issue of it, but I've always heard that Mr. Kerrigan at one time was a clown for Ringling Brothers Barney and Bailey Circus. And if this is true, why, it's certainly the truth, because I've seen him. I know him very well. He's a good friend of mine, and at times he can be very amusing and very congenial and amusing.
Can you think of any funny stories?
No, not really.
Okay. The reason I wondered, I'm going to talk to Mr. Kerrigan.
He is also a guard now at one of the gates on the King Ranch.
Mm-hmm. Last week we talked about the real fun has gone out of railroading since the steam engine is gone. The real craftsmanship, the real lore. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely correct. At one time, many years ago, when you had the steam engine, there was an art in running a steam engine. And this was something that wasn't experienced by everyone. It was kind of something that you was a little bit born with and learned a whole lot of the rest of it. But you could either feel an engine operating correctly, or you wasn't a natural born engineer. You just wasn't born for the job. And the same way with, like, tuning that whistle. There were some men that could tune one and play Yankee Doodle on it. And other men, if they started fooling with it, well, they couldn't even get it to blow. But an engineer was just a natural born individual. He came into his own. And there were so many things about running an engine. You could run one, and anyone that knew what you were doing, if they heard you, they knew whether or not you was an engineer, because they could tell by the sound of the engine and the way it was operating. It's kind of hard to explain in a way.
Could you give me a couple examples?
No, not really, because it's just that, well, a real running engine was not supposed to make too much noise, really. If you had what they call the stroke, if you had it cut off properly and the proper amount of steam, to where there wasn't any back pressure, things like that on the engine. In other words, you could feel it. You could actually feel a locomotive running if you knew what you were doing. Because when that locomotive turned them wheels, it would try to reach out like that, and you could feel that. But if you had the stroke cut too short and the steam would get in there and get trapped and would create a back pressure, you could feel that engine kind of trying to back up each stroke, that engine.
Was there a big difference between engines, steam engines, like a big difference in operating a big steamer as opposed to a smaller one?
Yes, there was a difference there, and a big, big difference between steam and diesel. Operating a diesel is just like driving a truck. You're just driving a big truck, so what you're doing nowadays. You're not running an engine on a railroad. You're just running a big truck.
The steam engine is supposed to be the more powerful of the two, isn't it?
The steam engine is the most powerful of the two. No, wait a minute. I'll take that back. Wait a minute. Take that back. Diesel engine is the most powerful. Because with a diesel engine, there is no dead center. Picture of a steam engine up there on the wall. Now, when them drivers on this side over here, mm-hmm. when they all come straight, and that side isn't pulling a bit, the other side is doing the pull. But it's for such a small amount of time that it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But when that piston is all the way in, it's not doing a thing. Or when it's all the way back here, it's not. So you can see that part of the time, half of that engine isn't doing a thing. Half of it on this side, and half of it on that side, and half of it on this side. But a diesel engine is pulling the entire circumference of the wheel. There's no dead motion in there at all because of the nature of the power.
I see. Supposedly someone told me that the more you opened up a steam engine, well, if you opened it up too much, it would blow up. Is that right?
No, it wouldn't necessarily blow up, but it wouldn't run as fast as if it, possibly if you just had it, four-fifths of the throttle was open, you'd probably get it running faster than you would if it was wide open because of the back pressures.
I see. How long did it take you before you, from the time you started the railroad till the time you became an engineer?
Well, of course, this varies. Years ago, when I was promoted, you had to have about 4 years' experience as a fireman. Today, this has been reduced drastically due to the feature of the engine. I really don't know what the requirement is today. I'm pretty sure, though, that boys have to be a fireman for about 6 months or a year before they're considered to be promoted. And then, of course, they have to write a book of the rules and the operation of the engine to prove to the railroad company that they understand. I mean, this is a book of questions they have to answer, is what it is. They don't write a book, they answer a book of questions. And this has to be done in front of the road foreman of engines. The road foreman of engines is the boss of engines, and his job is to ride up and down the railroad and to take care of any trouble anywhere up and down the railroad. So, of course, he's very familiar with the men in engine service. You're under his direct supervision.
Okay. Did you get to know any professional hobos, or?
I've seen at a distance, not to talk to them or become acquainted with them, but at a distance, I've seen some of the top-ranking hobos in their time. Don't remember exactly some of their names or anything, but speaking of hoboing, friend of mine named Dan Lynch, who also worked for the railroad, and myself had seen so many hobos and had heard so much about hoboing that we actually decided to try it ourselves. So for 10 months we were on the road, and by being on the road I mean we went from door to door and asked for food, and we slept in hobo camps, and we rode the rails, just like, well, we were hobos, is what we were, in the sense of the word. But we done this simply because we wanted to see firsthand about it.
What did you find out about hoboing?
Well, it's a rough way to live, of course, definitely. Our travels took us in every state east of the Mississippi River, except Florida. Now, we tried three times to enter Florida, and three times we were forcibly ejected. And the third time, the man told us that if we tried to get in there again, he was going to put us on the chain gang. Well, we had seen the chain gang from a distance, and this was back during the Depression, and we didn't want any part of the chain gang.
Did you ever see any of these hobos again after that?
No, we never did. Now, I've seen as many as 30 and 40 hobos get on a train leaving a station, an initial station, and I have seen whole families. A man and his wife, as many as three children, get on a freight train. And I've seen the old-time railroad dick with the club, everything else. I've outrun one or two of them myself.
This is actually outlawed, right? In other words, getting a free ride?
Oh, yeah.
And it was the job of the railroad detectives to keep people off?
Right.
How successful were they at doing it? Apparently not too successful.
Not too successfully back during the heart of the Depression, because some of those people weren't, well, I just wouldn't want to tangle with some of them. Some of them was real rough individuals because they didn't have anything to live for, really. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a place to eat or sleep, job, money or nothing. They didn't much care. things got pretty bad.
Let's talk about passenger trains just a little bit. How much passenger train experience did you have when you were a fireman or engineer?
Well, sir, I fired on passenger train quite often, but I never held a regular job as an engineer on a passenger train, but I fired on quite a few of them. And our passenger train, this is little known actually, but at one time we had a passenger train that was as fast or faster than the 20th Century Limited, famous New York Central Railroad. Our actual running time that we were actually operating that train was faster than the speed of that train.
How fast was that?
That was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I would think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70, possibly 75 miles an hour.